Starlet succumbs after 68-hour coma. I felt in my pocketbook among the paper scraps and the compact and the peanut shells and the dimes and nickels and the blue Jiffy box containing 19 Gillette blades till I unearthed the snapshot I'd taken that afternoon in the orange and white striped booth. I brought it up next to the smudgy photograph of the dead girl. It matched, mouth for mouth, nose for nose. The only difference was the eyes. The eyes in the snapshot were open, and those in the newspaper photograph were closed. But I knew if the dead girl's eyes were to be thumbed wide, they would look out at me with the same dead, black, vacant expression as the eyes in the snapshot. I stuffed the snapshot back in my pocketbook. I will just sit here in the sun on this park bench 5 minutes more by the clock on that building over there, I told myself, and then I will go somewhere and do it. I summoned my little chorus of voices. Doesn't your work interest you, Esther? You know, Esther, you've got a perfect setup of a true neurotic. You'll never get anywhere like that. You'll never get anywhere like that. You'll never get anywhere like that. Once, on a hot summer night, I had spent an hour kissing a hairy, ape-shaped law student from Yale because I felt sorry for him. He was so ugly. When I'd finished, he said, I have you typed, baby. You'll be a prude at 40. Factitious. My creative writing professor at college scrawled on a story of mine called The Big Weekend. I hadn't known what factitious meant, so I looked it up in the dictionary. Factitious. Artificial. Sham. You'll never get anywhere like that. I hadn't slept for 21 nights. I thought the most beautiful thing in the world must be shadow. The million moving shapes and cul-de-sacs of shadow. There was shadow in bureau drawers and closets and suitcases and shadow under houses and trees and stones and shadow at the back of people's eyes and smiles and shadow miles and miles and miles of it on the night side of the earth. I looked down at the two flesh-colored band-aids forming a cross on the calf of my right leg. That morning I had made a start. I had locked myself in the bathroom and run a tub full of warm water and taken out a Gillette blade. When they asked some old Roman philosopher or other how he wanted to die, he said he would open his veins in a warm bath. I thought it would be easy, lying in the bath and seeing the redness flower from my wrists, flush after flush through the clear water, till I sank to sleep under a surface gaudy as poppies. But when it came right down to it, the skin of my wrist looked so white and defenseless that I couldn't do it. It was as if what I wanted to kill wasn't in that skin, or the thin blue pulse that jumped under my thumb, but somewhere else, deeper, more secret, and a whole lot harder to get at. It would take two motions. One wrist, then the other wrist. Three motions if you counted changing the razor from hand to hand. Then I would step into the tub and lie down. I moved in front of the medicine cabinet. If I looked in the mirror while I did it, it would be like watching somebody else in a book or a play. But the person in the mirror was paralyzed and too stupid to do a thing. Then I thought maybe I ought to spill a little blood for practice, so I sat on the edge of the tub and crossed my right ankle over my left knee. Then I lifted my right hand with the razor and let it drop of its own weight like a guillotine onto the calf of my leg. I felt nothing. Then I felt a small, deep thrill, and a bright seam of red welled up at the lip of the slash. The blood gathered darkly like fruit and rolled down my ankle into the cup of my black patent leather shoe. I thought of getting into the tub then, but I realized my dallying had used up the better part of the morning and that my mother would probably come home and find me before I was done. So I bandaged the cut, packed up my Gillette blades, and caught the 11:30 bus to Boston. Sorry, baby, there's no subway to the Deer Island prison. It's on an island. No, it's not on an island. It used to be on an island, but they filled up the water with dirt, and now it joins onto the mainland. There's no subway. I've got to get there. Hey, the fat man in the ticket booth peered at me through the grating. Don't cry. Who you got there, honey? Some relative? People shoved and bumped by me in the artificially lit dark, hurrying after the trains that rumbled in and out of the intestinal tunnels under Scully Square. I could feel the tears start to spurt from the screwed-up nozzles of my eyes. It's my father. The fat man consulted a diagram on the wall of his booth. "Here's how you do," he said. "You take a car from that track over there and get off at Orient Heights, and then hop a bus with the point on it." He beamed at me. "It'll run you straight to the prison gate." "Hey, you!" A young fellow in a blue uniform waved from the hut. I waved back and kept on going. "Hey, you!" I stopped and walked slowly over to the hut that perched like a circular living room on the waste of sands. "Hey, you can't go any further. That's prison property. No trespassers allowed." "I thought you could go any place along the beach," I said, "so long as you stayed under the tide line." The fellow thought a minute. Then he said, "Not this beach." He had a pleasant, fresh face. "You have a nice place here," I said. "It's like a little house." He glanced back into the room with its braided rug and chintz curtains. He smiled. "We even got a coffee pot. I used to live near here." "No kidding? I was born and brought up in this town myself." I looked across the sands to the parking lot and the barred gate, and past the barred gate to the narrow road lapped by the ocean on both sides that led out to the one-time island. The red brick buildings of the prison looked friendly, like the buildings of a seaside college. On a green hump of lawn to the left, I could see small white spots and slightly larger pink spots moving about. I asked the guard what they were, and he said, "Them's pigs and chickens." I was thinking that if I'd had the sense to go on living in that old town, I might just have met this prison guard in school and married him and had a parcel of kids by now. It would be nice living by the sea with piles of little kids and pigs and chickens wearing what my grandmother called wash dresses and sitting about in some kitchen with bright linoleum and fat arms drinking pots of coffee. "How do you get into that prison?"
"You get a pass."
"No, how do you get locked in?"
"Oh," the guard laughed. "You steal a car, you rob a store."
"You got any murderers in there?"
"No. Murderers go to a big state place."
"Who else is in there?"
"Well, the first day of winter, we get these old bums out of Boston. They heave a brick through a window, and then they get picked up and spend the winter out of the cold with TV and plenty to eat and basketball games on the weekend."
"That's nice."
"Nice if you like it," said the guard.
I said goodbye and started to move off, glancing back over my shoulder only once. The guard still stood in the doorway of his observation booth, and when I turned, he lifted his arm in a salute. The log I sat on was lead-heavy and smelled of tar. Under the stout, gray cylinder of the water tower on its commanding hill, the sandbar curved out into the sea. At high tide, the bar completely submerged itself. I remembered that sandbar well. It harbored, in the crook of its inner curve, a particular shell that could be found nowhere else on the beach. The shell was thick, smooth, big as a thumb joint, and usually white, although sometimes pink or peach-colored. It resembled a sort of modest conch. "Mummy, that girl's still sitting there." I looked up idly and saw a small, sandy child being dragged up from the sea's edge by a skinny, bird-eyed woman in red shorts and a red and white polka-dot halter. I hadn't counted on the beach being overrun with summer people. In the 10 years of my absence, fancy blue and pink and pale green shanties had sprung up on the flat sands of the point like a crop of tasteless mushrooms, and the silver airplanes and cigar-shaped blimps had given way to jets that scoured the rooftops in their loud off-rush from the airport across the bay. I was the only girl on the beach in a skirt and high heels, and it occurred to me I must stand out. I had removed my patent leather shoes after a while, for they foundered badly in the sand. It pleased me to think they would be perched there on the silver log, pointing out to sea like a sort of soul compass after I was dead. I fingered the box of razors in my pocketbook. Then I thought how stupid I was. I had the razors, but no warm bath. I considered renting a room. There must be a boarding house among all those summer places, but I had no luggage. That would create suspicion. Besides, in a boarding house, other people are always wanting to use the bathroom. I'd hardly have time to do it and step into the tub when somebody would be pounding at the door. The gulls on their wooden stilts at the tip of the bar meowed like cats.
Then they flapped up one by one in their ash-colored jackets, circling my head and crying. "Say, lady, you better not sit out here. The tide's coming in." The small boy squatted a few feet away. He picked up a round purple stone and lobbed it into the water. The water swallowed it with a resonant plop. Then he scrabbled around, and I heard the dry stones clank together like money. He skimmed a flat stone over the dull green surface, and it skipped 7 times before it sliced out of sight. "Why don't you go home?" I said. The boy skipped another heavier stone. It sank after the 2nd bounce. "Don't want to. Your mother's looking for you." "She is not." He sounded worried. "If you go home, I'll give you some candy." The boy hitched closer. "What kind?" But I knew without looking into my pocketbook that all I had was peanut shells. "I'll give you some money to buy some candy." "Arthur!" A woman was indeed coming out on the sandbar, slipping and no doubt cursing to herself, for her lips went up and down between her clear, peremptory calls. "Arthur!" She shaded her eyes with one hand as if this helped her discern us through the thickening sea dusk. I could sense the boy's interest dwindle as the pull of his mother increased. He began to pretend he didn't know me. He kicked over a few stones as if searching for something and edged off. I shivered. The stones lay lumpish and cold under my bare feet. I thought longingly of the black shoes on the beach. A wave drew back like a hand, then advanced and touched my foot. The drench seemed to come off the sea floor itself, where blind whitefish ferried themselves by their own light through the great polar cold. I saw sharks' teeth and whales' ear bones littered about down there like gravestones. I waited, as if the sea could make my decision for me. A 2nd wave collapsed over my feet, lipped with white froth, and the chill gripped my ankles with a mortal ache. My flesh winced in cowardice from such a death. I picked up my pocketbook and started back over the cold stones to where my shoes kept their vigil in the violet light. Of course, his mother killed him. I looked at the mouth of the boy Jody had wanted me to meet. His lips were thick and pink, and a baby face nestled under the silk of white blonde hair. His name was Cal, which I thought must be short for something, but I couldn't think what it would be short for unless it was California. "How can you be sure she killed him?" I said. Cal was supposed to be very intelligent, and Jody had said over the phone that he was cute and I would like him. I wondered if I'd been my old self if I would have liked him. It was impossible to tell. Well, first she says no, 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 and then she says yes. But then she says no, no again. Cal and I lay side by side on an orange and green striped towel on a mucky beach across the swamps from Lynn. Jody and Mark, the boy she was pinned to, were swimming. Cal hadn't wanted to swim. He had wanted to talk, and we were arguing about this play where a young man finds out he has a brain disease on account of his father fooling around with unclean women, and in the end his brain, which has been softening all along, snaps completely, and his mother is debating whether to kill him or not. I had a suspicion that my mother had called Jody and begged her to ask me out so I wouldn't sit around in my room all day with the shades drawn. I didn't want to go at first, because I thought Jody would notice the change in me and that anybody with half an eye would see I didn't have a brain in my head. But all during the drive north and then east, Jody had joked and laughed and chattered and not seemed to mind that I only said my or gosh or you don't say. We browned hot dogs on the public grills at the beach, and by watching Jody and Mark and Cal very carefully, I managed to cook my hot dog just the right amount of time and didn't burn it or drop it into the fire the way I was afraid of doing. Then, when nobody was looking, I buried it in the sand. After we ate, Jody and Mark ran down to the water hand in hand, and I lay back, staring into the sky while Cal went on and on about this play. The only reason I remembered this play was because it had a mad person in it. And everything I had ever read about mad people stuck in my mind while everything else flew out. But it's the yes that matters, Cal said. It's the yes she'll come back to in the end. I lifted my head and squinted out at the bright blue plate of the sea. A bright blue plate with a dirty rim. A big round gray rock, like the upper half of an egg, poked out of the water about a mile from the stony headland. What was she going to kill him with? I forget. I hadn't forgotten. I remembered perfectly well, but I wanted to hear what Cal would say. Morphia powders. Do you suppose they have morphia powders in America? Cal considered a minute. Then he said, I wouldn't think so. They sound awfully old-fashioned. I rolled over onto my stomach and squinted at the view in the other direction, toward Lynn. A glassy haze rippled up from the fires and the grills and the heat on the road, and through the haze, as through a curtain of clear water, I could make out a smudgy skyline of gas tanks and factory stacks and derricks and bridges. It looked like one hell of a mess. I rolled onto my back again and made my voice casual. If you were going to kill yourself, how would you do it? Cal seemed pleased. I've often thought of that. I'd blow my brains out with a gun. I was disappointed. It was just like a man to do it with a gun. A fat chance I had of laying my hands on a gun. And even if I did, I wouldn't have a clue as to what part of me to shoot at. I'd already read in the papers about people who tried to shoot themselves, only they ended up shooting an important nerve and getting paralyzed or blasting their face off but being saved by surgeons in a sort of miracle from dying outright. The risks of a gun seemed great. What kind of gun? My father's shotgun. He keeps it loaded. I'd just have to walk into his study one day and Cal pointed a finger to his temple and made a comical screwed-up face. Click! He widened his pale gray eyes and looked at me. Does your father happen to live near Boston? I asked idly. Nope. In Clacton-on-Sea, he's English. Jody and Mark ran up hand in hand, dripping and shaking off water drops like two loving puppies. I thought there would be too many people, so I stood up and pretended to yawn. I guess I'll go for a swim. Being with Jody and Mark and Cal was beginning to weigh on my nerves like a dull wooden block on the strings of a piano. I was afraid that at any moment my control would snap, and I would start babbling about how I couldn't read and couldn't write and how I must be just about the only person who had stayed awake for a solid month without dropping dead of exhaustion. A smoke seemed to be going up from my nerves like the smoke from the grills and the sun-saturated road. The whole landscape, beach and headland and sea and rock, quavered in front of my eyes like a stage backcloth. I wondered at what point in space the silly sham blue of the sky turned black. You swim too, Cal. Jody gave Cal a playful little push. Oh, Cal hid his face in the towel. It's too cold. I started to walk toward the water. Somehow, in the broad, shadowless light of noon, the water looked amiable and welcoming. I thought drowning must be the kindest way to die, and burning the worst. Some of those babies in the jars that Buddy Willard showed me had gills, he said. They went through a stage where they were just like fish. A little rubbishy wavelet full of candy wrappers and orange peel and seaweed folded over my foot. I heard the sand thud behind me, and Cal came up. Let's swim to that rock out there. I pointed at it. Are you crazy? That's a mile out. What are you? I said. Chicken? Cal took me by the elbow and jostled me into the water. When we were waist high, he pushed me under. I surfaced, splashing, my eyes seared with salt. Underneath the water was green and semi-opaque as a hunk of quartz. I started to swim, a modified dog paddle, keeping my face toward the rock. Cal did a slow crawl. After a while, he put his head up and treaded water. Can't make it. He was panting heavily. Okay, you go back. I thought I would swim out until I was too tired to swim back. As I paddled on, my heartbeat boomed like a dull motor in my ears. I am. I am. I am. That morning I had tried to hang myself. I had taken the silk cord of my mother's yellow bathrobe as soon as she left for work and in the amber shade of the bedroom fashioned it into a knot that slipped up and down on itself. It took me a long time to do this because I was poor at knots and had no idea how to make a proper one. Then I hunted for a place to attach the rope. The trouble was, our house had the wrong kind of ceilings. The ceilings were low, white, and smoothly plastered without a light fixture or a wood beam in sight. I thought with longing of the house my grandmother had before she sold it to come and live with us, and then with my Aunt Libby. My grandmother's house was built in a fine 19th century style with lofty rooms and sturdy chandelier brackets and high closets with stout rails across them and an attic where nobody ever went full of trunks and parrot cages and dressmaker's dummies and overhead beams thick as ship's timbers. But it was an old house and she'd sold it and I didn't know anybody else with a house like that. After a discouraging time of walking about with the silk cord dangling from my neck like a yellow cat's tail and finding no place to fasten it, I sat on the edge of my mother's bed and tried pulling the cord tight. But each time I would get the cord so tight I could feel a rushing in my ears and a flush of blood in my face, my hands would weaken and let go and I would be all right again. Then I saw that my body had all sorts of little tricks, such as making my hands go limp at the crucial second, which would save it. Time and again, whereas if I had the whole say, I would be dead in a flash. I would simply have to ambush it with whatever sense I had left, or it would trap me in its stupid cage for 50 years without any sense at all. And when people found out my mind had gone, as they would have to sooner or later in spite of my mother's guarded tongue, they would persuade her to put me into an asylum where I would be cured. Only my case was incurable. I had bought a few paperbacks on abnormal psychology at the drugstore and compared my symptoms with the symptoms in the books, and sure enough, my symptoms tallied with the most hopeless cases. The only thing I could read besides the scandal sheets were those abnormal psychology books. It was as if some slim opening had been left so I could learn all I needed to know about my case to end it in the proper way. I wondered, after the hanging fiasco, if I shouldn't just give it up and turn myself over to the doctors. And then I remembered Dr. Gordon and his private shock machine. Once I was locked up, they could use it on me all the time. And I thought of how my mother and brother and friends would visit me, day after day, hoping I would be better. Then their visits would slacken off and they would give up hope. They would grow old, they would forget me. They would be poor, too. They would want me to have the best of care at first, so they would sink all their money in a private hospital like Dr. Gordon's. Finally, when the money was used up, I would be moved to a state hospital with hundreds of people like me in a big cage in the basement. The more hopeless you were, the further away they hid you. Cal had turned around and was swimming in. As I watched, he dragged himself slowly out of the neck-deep sea. Against the khaki-colored sand and the green shore wavelets, his body was bisected for a moment like a white worm. Then it crawled completely out of the green and onto the khaki and lost itself among dozens and dozens of other worms that were wriggling or just rolling about between the sea and the sky. I paddled my hands in the water and kicked my feet. The egg-shaped rock didn't seem to be any nearer than it had been when Cal and I looked at it from the shore. Then I saw it would be pointless to swim as far as the rock because my body would take that excuse to climb out and lie in the sun, gathering strength to swim back. The only thing to do was to drown myself then and there. So I stopped. I brought my hands to my breast, ducked my head, and dived, using my hands to push the water aside. The water pressed in on my eardrums and on my heart. I fanned myself down, but before I knew where I was, the water had spat me up into the sun. The world was sparkling all about me like blue and green and yellow semi-precious stones. I dashed the water from my eyes. I was panting, as after a strenuous exertion, but floating without effort. I dived and dived again, and each time popped up like a cork. The gray rock mocked me. Bobbing on the water easy as a life buoy. I knew when I was beaten. I turned back. The flowers nodded like bright, knowledgeable children as I trundled them down the hall. I felt silly in my sage-green volunteer's uniform, and superfluous, unlike the white-uniformed doctors and nurses or even the brown-uniformed scrub women with their mops and their buckets of grimy water who passed me without a word. If I had been getting paid, no matter how little, I could at least count this a proper job, but all I got for a morning of pushing around magazines and candy and flowers was a free lunch. My mother said the cure for thinking too much about yourself was helping somebody who was worse off than you. So, Teresa had arranged for me to sign on as a volunteer at our local hospital. It was difficult to be a volunteer at this hospital because that's what all the junior league women wanted to do. But luckily for me, a lot of them were away on vacation. I hoped they would send me to a ward with some really gruesome cases, who would see through my numb, dumb face to how I meant well and be grateful. But the head of the volunteers, a society lady at our church, took one look at me and said, "You're on maternity." So I rode the elevator up 3 flights to the maternity ward and reported to the head nurse. She gave me a trolley of flowers. I was supposed to put the right vases at the right beds in the right rooms. But before I came to the door of the first room, I noticed that a lot of the flowers were droopy and brown at the edges. I thought it would be discouraging for a woman who just had a baby to see somebody plonk down a big bouquet of dead flowers in front of her. So I steered the trolley to a wash basin in an alcove in the hall and began to pick out all the flowers that were dead. Then I picked out all those that were dying. There was no wastebasket in sight, so I crumbled the flowers up and laid them in the deep white basin. The basin felt cold as a tomb. I smiled. This must be how they laid the bodies away in the hospital morgue. My gesture in its small way echoed the larger gesture of doctors and nurses. I swung the door of the first room open and walked in, dragging my trolley. A couple of nurses jumped up and I had a confused impression of shelves and medicine cabinets. "What do you want?" one of the nurses demanded sternly. I couldn't tell one from the other. They all looked just alike. "I'm taking the flowers around." The nurse who had spoken put a hand on my shoulder and led me out of the room, maneuvering the trolley with her free, expert hand. She flung open the swinging doors of the room next to that one and bowed me in. Then she disappeared. I could hear giggles in the distance till a door shut and cut them off. There were 6 beds in the room, and each bed had a woman in it. The women were all sitting up and knitting or riffling through magazines or putting their hair in pin curls and chattering like parrots in a parrot house. I had thought they would be sleeping or lying quiet and pale so I could tiptoe round without any trouble and match the bed numbers to the numbers inked on adhesive tape on the vases, but before I had a chance to get my bearings, a bright, jazzy blonde with a sharp triangular face beckoned to me. I approached her, leaving the trolley in the middle of the floor, but then she made an impatient gesture and I saw she wanted me to bring the trolley too. I wheeled the trolley over to her bedside with a helpful smile. "Hey, where's my larkspur?" A large, flabby lady from across the ward raked me with an eagle eye. The sharp-faced blonde bent over the trolley. "Here are my yellow roses," she said, "but they're all mixed up with some lousy iris." Other voices joined the voices of the first 2 women. They sounded cross and loud and full of complaint. I was opening my mouth to explain that I had thrown a bunch of dead larkspur in the sink and that some of the vases I had weeded out looked skimpy. There were so few flowers left, so I had joined a few of the bouquets together to fill them out, when the swinging door flew open and a nurse stalked in to see what the commotion was. "Listen, nurse, I had this big bunch of larkspur Larry brought last night. She's loused up my yellow roses." Unbuttoning the green uniform as I ran, I stuffed it in passing into the wash basin with the rubbish of dead flowers. Then I took the deserted side steps down to the street 2 at a time without meeting another soul. "Which way is the graveyard?" The Italian in the black leather jacket stopped and pointed down an alley behind the white Methodist church. I remembered the Methodist church. I had been a Methodist for the first 9 years of my life before my father died and we moved and turned Unitarian. My mother had been a Catholic before she was a Methodist. My grandmother and my grandfather and my Aunt Libby were all still Catholics. My Aunt Libby had broken away from the Catholic Church at the same time my mother did, but then she'd fallen in love with an Italian Catholic, so she'd gone back again. Lately, I had considered going into the Catholic Church myself. I knew that Catholics thought killing yourself was an awful sin, but perhaps if this was so, they might have a good way to persuade me out of it. Of course, I didn't believe in life after death or the virgin birth or the Inquisition or the infallibility of that little monkey-faced pope or anything, but I didn't have to let the priest see this. I could just concentrate on my sin, and he would help me repent. The only trouble was, church, even the Catholic Church, didn't take up the whole of your life. No matter how much you knelt and prayed, you still had to eat 3 meals a day and have a job and live in the world. I thought I might see how long you had to be a Catholic before you became a nun, so I asked my mother, thinking she'd know the best way to go about it. My mother had laughed at me. "Do you think they'll take somebody like you right off the bat? Why, you've got to know all these catechisms and credos and believe in them lock, stock, and barrel. A girl with your sense." Still, I imagined myself going to some Boston priest. It would have to be Boston because I didn't want any priest in my hometown to know I'd thought of killing myself. Priests were terrible gossips. I would be in black with my dead white face, and I would throw myself at this priest's feet and say, "Oh, Father, help me." But that was before people had begun to look at me in a funny way like those nurses in the hospital. I was pretty sure the Catholics wouldn't take in any crazy nuns. My Aunt Libby's husband had made a joke once about a nun that a nunnery sent to Teresa for a checkup. This nun kept hearing harp notes in her ears and a voice saying over and over, "Alleluia." Only she wasn't sure, on being closely questioned, whether the voice was saying "Alleluia" or "Arizona." The nun had been born in Arizona. I think she ended up in some asylum. I tugged my black veil down to my chin and strode in through the wrought iron gates. I thought it odd that in all the time my father had been buried in this graveyard, none of us had ever visited him. My mother hadn't let us come to his funeral because we were only children then, and he had died in the hospital, so the graveyard and even his death had always seemed unreal to me. I had a great yearning lately to pay my father back for all the years of neglect and start tending his grave. I had always been my father's favorite, and it seemed fitting I should take on a mourning my mother had never bothered with. I thought that if my father hadn't died, he would have taught me all about insects, which was his specialty at the university. He would also have taught me German and Greek and Latin, which he knew, and perhaps I would be a Lutheran. My father had been a Lutheran in Wisconsin, but they were out of style in New England, so he'd become a lapsed Lutheran, and then, my mother said, a bitter atheist. The graveyard disappointed me. It lay at the outskirts of the town on low ground, like a rubbish dump, and as I walked up and down the gravel paths, I could smell the stagnant salt marshes in the distance. The old part of the graveyard was all right, with its worn flat stones and lichen-bitten monuments. But I soon saw my father must be buried in the modern part with dates in the 1940s. The stones in the modern part were crude and cheap, and here and there a grave was rimmed with marble, like an oblong bathtub full of dirt, and rusty metal containers stuck up about where the person's navel would be, full of plastic flowers. A fine drizzle started drifting down from the gray sky, and I grew very depressed. I couldn't find my father anywhere. Low, shaggy clouds scudded over that part of the horizon where the sea lay, behind the marshes and the beach shanty settlements, and raindrops darkened the black Macintosh I had brought that morning. A clammy dampness sank through to my skin. I had asked the sales girl, "Is it water repellent?" And she had said, "No raincoat is ever water repellent. It's showerproofed." And when I asked her what showerproofed was, she told me I had better buy an umbrella. But I hadn't enough money for an umbrella, what with bus fare in and out of Boston and peanuts and newspapers and abnormal psychology books and trips to my old home by the sea, my New York fund was almost exhausted. I had decided that when there was no more money in my bank account, I would do it. And that morning I'd spent the last of it on the black raincoat. Then I saw my father's gravestone. It was crowded right up by another gravestone, head to head, the way people are crowded in a charity ward when there isn't enough space. The stone was of a mottled pink marble, like canned salmon, and all there was on it was my father's name and, under it, two dates, separated by a little dash. At the foot of the stone, I arranged the rainy armful of azaleas I had picked from a bush at the gateway of the graveyard. Then my legs folded under me and I sat down in the sopping grass. I couldn't understand why I was crying so hard. Then I remembered that I had never cried for my father's death. My mother hadn't cried either. She had just smiled and said what a merciful thing it was for him he had died, because if he had lived, he would have been crippled and an invalid for life, and he couldn't have stood that. He would rather have died than had that happen. I laid my face to the smooth face of the marble and howled my loss into the cold, salt rain. I knew just how to go about it. The minute the car tires crunched off down the drive and the sound of the motor faded, I jumped out of bed and hurried into my white blouse and green figured skirt and black raincoat. The raincoat felt damp still from the day before, but that would soon cease to matter. I went downstairs and picked up a pale blue envelope from the dining room table and scrawled on the back in large, painstaking letters, "I am going for a long walk." I propped the message where my mother would see it the minute she came in. Then I laughed. I had forgotten the most important thing. I ran upstairs and dragged a chair into my mother's closet. Then I climbed up and reached for the small green strong box on the top shelf. I could have torn the metal cover off with my bare hands, the lock was so feeble, but I wanted to do things in a calm, orderly way. I pulled out my mother's upper right-hand bureau drawer and slipped the blue jewelry box from its hiding place under the scented Irish linen handkerchiefs. I unpinned the little key from the dark velvet. Then I unlocked the strong box and took out the bottle of new pills. There were more than I had hoped. There were at least 50. If I had waited until my mother doled them out to me night by night, it would have taken me 50 nights to save up enough. And in 50 nights, college would have opened, and my brother would have come back from Germany, and it would be too late. I pinned the key back in the jewelry box among the clutter of inexpensive chains and rings, put the jewelry box back in the drawer under the handkerchiefs, returned the strong box to the closet shelf, and set the chair on the rug in the exact spot I had dragged it from. Then I went downstairs and into the kitchen. I turned on the tap and poured myself a tall glass of water. Then I took the glass of water and the bottle of pills and went down into the cellar. A dim, undersea light filtered through the slits of the cellar windows. Behind the oil burner, a dark gap showed in the wall at about shoulder height and ran back under the breezeway out of sight. The breezeway had been added to the house after the cellar was dug and built out over this secret earth-bottomed crevice. A few old, rotting fireplace logs blocked the whole mouth. I shoved them back a bit. Then I set the glass of water and the bottle of pills side by side on the flat surface of one of the logs and started to heave myself up. It took me a good while to heft my body into the gap, but at last, after many tries, I managed it and crouched at the mouth of the darkness like a troll. The earth seemed friendly under my bare feet, but cold. I wondered how long it had been since this particular square of soil had seen the sun. Then, one after the other, I lugged the heavy, dust-covered logs across the whole mouth. The dark felt thick as velvet. I reached for the glass and bottle, and carefully on my knees, with bent head, crawled to the farthest wall. Cobwebs touched my face with the softness of moths. Wrapping my black coat round me like my own sweet shadow, I unscrewed the bottle of pills and started taking them swiftly between gulps of water, one by one by one. At first, nothing happened, but as I approached the bottom of the bottle, red and blue lights began to flash before my eyes. The bottle slid from my fingers and I lay down. The silence drew off, barring the pebbles and shells and all the tatty wreckage of my life. Then at the rim of vision, it gathered itself and in one sweeping tide rushed me to sleep. It was completely dark. I felt the darkness, but nothing else, and my head rose, feeling it like the head of a worm. Someone was moaning. Then a great, hard weight smashed against my cheek like a stone wall, and the moaning stopped. The silence surged back, smoothing itself as black water smooths to its old surface calm over a dropped stone. A cool wind rushed by. I was being transported at enormous speed down a tunnel into the earth. Then the wind stopped. There was a rumbling as of many voices protesting and disagreeing in the distance. Then the voices stopped. A chisel cracked down on my eye, and a slit of light opened, like a mouth or a wound, till the darkness clamped shut on it again. I tried to roll away from the direction of the light, but hands wrapped round my limbs like mummy hands, and I couldn't move. I began to think I must be in an underground chamber lit by blinding lights and that the chamber was full of people who for some reason were holding me down. Then the chisel struck again and the light leapt into my head and through the thick, warm, furry dark, a voice cried, "Mother!" Air breathed and played over my face. I felt the shape of a room around me, a big room with open windows. A pillow molded itself under my head, and my body floated, without pressure, between thin sheets. Then I felt warmth, like a hand on my face. I must be lying in the sun. If I opened my eyes, I would see colors and shapes bending in upon me like nurses. I opened my eyes. It was completely dark. Somebody was breathing beside me. "I can't see," I said. A cheery voice spoke out of the dark. "There are lots of blind people in the world. You'll marry a nice blind man someday." The man with the chisel had come back. "Why do you bother?" I said. "It's no use. You mustn't talk like that." His fingers probed at the great aching boss over my left eye. Then he loosened something, and a ragged gap of light appeared like a hole in a wall. A man's head peered round the edge of it. "Can you see me?"
"Yes."
"Can you see anything else?" Then I remembered. "I can't see anything." The gap narrowed and went dark. "I'm blind."
"Nonsense. Who told you that?"
"The nurse." The man snorted. He finished taping the bandage back over my eye.
"You're a very lucky girl. Your sight is perfectly intact."
"Somebody to see you." The nurse beamed and disappeared. My mother came smiling round the foot of the bed. She was wearing a dress with purple cartwheels on it, and she looked awful. A big, tall boy followed her. At first I couldn't make out who it was because my eye only opened a short way, but then I saw it was my brother. "They said you wanted to see me." My mother perched on the edge of the bed and laid a hand on my leg. She looked loving and reproachful, and I wanted her to go away. I didn't think I said anything.
"They said you called for me."
She seemed ready to cry. Her face puckered up and quivered like a pale jelly.
"Who are you?"
my brother said. I looked my mother in the eye. "The same," I said.
"You have a visitor."
"I don't want a visitor." The nurse bustled out and whispered to somebody in the hall. Then she came back. "He'd very much like to see you." I looked down at the yellow leg sticking out of the unfamiliar white silk pajamas they had dressed me in. The skin shook flabbily when I moved as if there wasn't a muscle in it, and it was covered with a short, thick stubble of black hair.
"Who is it?"
"Somebody you know."
"What's his name?"
"George Bakewell."
"I don't know any George Bakewell."
"He says he knows you." Then the nurse went out, and a very familiar boy came in and said, "Mind if I sit on the edge of your bed?" He was wearing a white coat, and I could see a stethoscope poking out of his pocket. I thought it must be somebody I knew dressed up as a doctor. I had meant to cover my legs if anybody came in, but now I saw it was too late, so I let them stick out just as they were, disgusting and ugly.
"That's me," I thought. "That's what I am."
"You remember me, don't you, Esther?" I squinted at the boy's face through the crack of my good eye. The other eye hadn't opened yet, but the doctor said it would be all right in a few days. The boy looked at me as if I were some exciting new zoo animal and he was about to burst out laughing.
You remember me, don't you, Esther?
He spoke slowly, the way one speaks to a dull child. I'm George Bakewell. I go to your church. You dated my roommate once at Amherst. I thought I placed the boy's face then. It hovered dimly in the rim of memory, the sort of face to which I would never bother to attach a name. What are you doing here?
I'm houseman at this hospital.
How could this George Bakewell have become a doctor so suddenly? I wondered. He didn't really know me either. He just wanted to see what a girl who was crazy enough to kill herself looked like. I turned my face to the wall.
Get out, I said. Get the hell out and don't come back.
I want to see a mirror. The nurse hummed busily as she opened one drawer after another, stuffing the new underclothes and blouses and skirts and pajamas my mother had bought me into a black patent leather overnight case. Why can't I see a mirror? I had been dressed in a sheath, striped gray and white, like mattress ticking, with a wide, shiny red belt, and they had propped me up in an armchair. Why can't I?
Because you better not.
The nurse shut the lid of the overnight case with a little snap.
Why?
Because you don't look very pretty.
Oh, just let me see.
The nurse sighed and opened the top bureau drawer. She took out a large mirror in a wooden frame that matched the wood of the bureau and handed it to me. At first I didn't see what the trouble was. It wasn't a mirror at all, but a picture. You couldn't tell whether the person in the picture was a man or a woman, because their hair was shaved off and sprouted in bristly chicken feather tufts all over their head. One side of the person's face was purple and bulged out in a shapeless way, shading to green along the edges and then to a sallow yellow. The person's mouth was pale brown, with a rose-colored sore at either corner. The most startling thing about the face was its supernatural conglomeration of bright colors. I smiled. The mouth in the mirror cracked into a grin. A minute after the crash, another nurse ran in. She took one look at the broken mirror and at me, standing over the blind, white pieces, and hustled the young nurse out of the room.
Didn't I tell you? I could hear her say. But I only... Didn't I tell you?
I listened with mild interest. Anybody could drop a mirror. I didn't see why they should get so stirred up. The other, older nurse came back into the room. She stood there, arms folded, staring hard at me. 7 years, bad luck. What? I said, the nurse raised her voice as if speaking to a deaf person. 7 years, bad luck. The young nurse returned with a dustpan and brush and began to sweep up the glittery splinters. That's only a superstition, I said then. Huh. The second nurse addressed herself to the nurse on her hands and knees as if I wasn't there. At you know where, they'll take care of her. From the back window of the ambulance, I could see street after familiar street funneling off into a summery green distance. My mother sat on one side of me and my brother on the other. I had pretended I didn't know why we were moving me from the hospital in my hometown to a city hospital, to see what they would say. They want you to be in a special ward, my mother said. They don't have that sort of ward at our hospital. I liked it where I was. My mother's mouth tightened. You should have behaved better then.
What?
You shouldn't have broken that mirror, then maybe they'd have let you stay. But, of course, I knew the mirror had nothing to do with it. I sat in bed with the covers up to my neck. Why can't I get up? I'm not sick. Ward rounds, the nurse said. You can get up after ward rounds. She shoved the bed curtains back and revealed a fat young Italian woman in the next bed. The Italian woman had a mass of tight black curls, starting at her forehead that rose in a mountainous pompadour and cascaded down her back. Whenever she moved, the huge arrangement of hair moved with her, as if made of stiff black paper. The woman looked at me and giggled. Why are you here? She didn't wait for an answer. I'm here on account of my French-Canadian mother-in-law. She giggled again. My husband knows I can't stand her, and still he said she could come and visit us, and when she came, my tongue stuck out of my head. I couldn't stop it. They ran me into emergency, and then they put me up here. She lowered her voice, along with the nuts. Then she said, what's the matter with you? I turned her my full face, with the bulging purple and green eye. I tried to kill myself. The woman stared at me. Then hastily, she snatched up a movie magazine from her bed table and pretended to be reading. The swinging door opposite my bed flew open, and a whole troop of young boys and girls in white coats came in with an older, gray-haired man. They were all smiling with bright, artificial smiles. They grouped themselves at the foot of my bed. And how are you feeling this morning, Miss Greenwood? I tried to decide which one of them had spoken. I hate saying anything to a group of people. When I talk to a group of people, I always have to single out one and talk to him. And all the while I'm talking, I feel the others are peering at me and taking unfair advantage. I also hate people to ask cheerfully how you are when they know you're feeling like hell and expect you to say fine. I feel lousy. Lousy, somebody said. And a boy ducked his head with a little smile. Somebody else scribbled something on a clipboard. Then somebody pulled a straight, solemn face and said, and why do you feel lousy? I thought some of the boys and girls in that bright group might well be friends of Buddy Willard. They would know I knew him, and they would be curious to see me, and afterward they would gossip about me among themselves. I wanted to be where nobody I knew could ever come. I can't sleep. They interrupted me, but the nurse says you slept last night. I looked around the crescent of fresh, strange faces. I can't read, I raised my voice. I can't eat. It occurred to me I'd been eating ravenously ever since I came to. The people in the group had turned from me and were murmuring in low voices to each other. Finally, the gray-haired man stepped out. Thank you, Miss Greenwood. You will be seeing one of the staff doctors presently. Then the group moved on to the bed of the Italian woman. And how are you feeling today, Mrs.? Somebody said. And the name sounded long and full of eyes, like Mrs. Tomalio. Mrs. Tomalio giggled. Oh, I'm fine, doctor, I'm just fine. Then she lowered her voice and whispered something I couldn't hear. One or two people in the group glanced in my direction. Then somebody said, all right, Mrs. Tomalio. And somebody stepped out and pulled the bed curtain between us like a white wall. I sat on one end of a wooden bench in a grassy square between the four brick walls of the hospital. My mother, in her purple cartwheel dress, sat at the other end. She had her head propped in her hand, index finger on her cheek and thumb under her chin. Mrs. Tomalio was sitting with some dark-haired, laughing Italian on the next bench down. Every time my mother moved, Mrs. Tomalio imitated her. Now Mrs. Tomalio was sitting with her index finger on her cheek and her thumb under her chin and her head tilted wistfully to one side. Don't move, I told my mother in a low voice. That woman's imitating you. My mother turned to glance round, but quick as a wink, Mrs. Tomalio dropped her fat white hands in her lap and started talking vigorously to her friends. Why, no, she's not, my mother said. She's not even paying any attention to us. But the minute my mother turned round to me again, Mrs. Tomalio matched the tips of her fingers together the way my mother had just done and cast a black, mocking look at me. The lawn was white with doctors. All the time my mother and I had been sitting there in the narrow cone of sun that shone down between the tall brick walls, doctors had been coming up to me and introducing themselves. I'm Dr. So-and-so. I'm Dr. So-and-so. Some of them looked so young, I knew they couldn't be proper doctors. And one of them had a queer name that sounded just like Dr. Syphilis. So I began to look out for suspicious fake names, and sure enough, a dark-haired fellow who looked very like Dr. Gordon, except that he had black skin where Dr. Gordon's skin was white, came up and said, I'm Dr. Pancreas, and shook my hand. After introducing themselves, the doctors all stood within listening distance, only I couldn't tell my mother that they were taking down every word we said without their hearing me, so I leaned over and whispered into her ear. My mother drew back sharply. Oh, Esther, I wish you would cooperate. They say you don't cooperate. They say you won't talk to any of the doctors or make anything in occupational therapy. I've got to get out of here, I told her meaningly. Then I'd be all right. You got me in here, I said. You get me out.
I thought if only I could persuade my mother to get me out of the hospital, I could work on her sympathies like that boy with brain disease in the play and convince her what was the best thing to do. To my surprise, my mother said, "All right, I'll try to get you out. Even if only to a better place, if I try to get you out," she laid a hand on my knee, "promise you'll be good?" I spun round and glared straight at Dr. Syphilis, who stood at my elbow taking notes on a tiny, almost invisible pad. "I promise," I said in a loud, conspicuous voice. The Negro wheeled the food cart into the patient's dining room. The psychiatric ward at the hospital was very small, just two corridors in an L shape lined with rooms and an alcove of beds behind the OT shop where I was, and a little area with a table and a few seats by a window in the corner of the L, which was our lounge and dining room. Usually it was a shrunken old white man that brought our food, but today it was a Negro. The Negro was with a woman in blue stiletto heels, and she was telling him what to do. The Negro kept grinning and chuckling in a silly way. Then he carried a tray over to our table with three lidded tin tureens on it and started banging the tureens down. The woman left the room, locking the door behind her. All the time the Negro was banging down the tureens and then the dinted silver and the thick white china plates, he gawped at us with big rolling eyes. I could tell we were his first crazy people. Nobody at the table made a move to take the lids off the tin tureens, and the nurse stood back to see if any of us would take the lids off before she came to do it. Usually Mrs. Tomalio had taken the lids off and dished out everybody's food like a little mother, but then they sent her home and nobody seemed to want to take her place. I was starving, so I lifted the lid off the first bowl. "That's very nice of you, Esther," the nurse said pleasantly. "Would you like to take some beans and pass them round to the others?" I dished myself out a helping of green string beans and turned to pass the tureen to the enormous red-headed woman at my right. This was the first time the red-headed woman had been allowed up to the table. I had seen her once, at the very end of the L-shaped corridor, standing in front of an open door with bars on the square, inset windows. She had been yelling and laughing in a rude way and slapping her thighs at the passing doctors, and the white-jacketed attendant who took care of the people in that end of the ward was leaning against the hall radiator, laughing himself sick. The red-headed woman snatched the tureen from me and upended it on her plate. Beans mountained up in front of her and scattered over onto her lap and onto the floor like stiff green straws. "Oh, Mrs. Mole," the nurse said in a sad voice, "I think you better eat in your room today." And she returned most of the beans to the tureen and gave it to the person next to Mrs. Mole and led Mrs. Mole off. All the way down the hall to her room, Mrs. Mole kept turning round and making leering faces at us and ugly oinking noises. The Negro had come back and was starting to collect the empty plates of people who hadn't dished out any beans yet. "We're not done," I told him. "You can just wait." "Mama." The Negro widened his eyes in mock wonder. He glanced round. The nurse had not yet returned from locking up Mrs. Mole. The Negro made an insolent bow. "Miss Mucky Muck," he said under his breath. I lifted the lid off the second tureen and uncovered a wedge of macaroni, stone cold and stuck together in a gluey paste. The third and last tureen was chock full of baked beans. Now, I knew perfectly well you didn't serve two kinds of beans together at a meal. Beans and carrots, or beans and peas, maybe, but never beans and beans. The Negro was just trying to see how much we would take. The nurse came back, and the Negro edged off at a distance. I ate as much as I could of the baked beans, then I rose from the table, passing round to the side where the nurse couldn't see me below the waist, and behind the Negro who was clearing the dirty plates, I drew my foot back and gave him a sharp, hard kick on the calf of the leg. The Negro leapt away with a yelp and rolled his eyes at me. Oh, Miz," he moaned, rubbing his leg. "You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't, you really shouldn't." "That's what you get," I said, and stared him in the eye. "Don't you want to get up today?" "No." I huddled down more deeply in the bed and pulled the sheet up over my head. Then I lifted a corner of the sheet and peered out. The nurse was shaking down the thermometer she had just removed from my mouth. "You see, it's normal." I had looked at the thermometer before she came to collect it, the way I always did. "You see, it's normal. What do you keep taking it for?"
I wanted to tell her that if only something were wrong with my body, it would be fine. I would rather have anything wrong with my body than something wrong with my head. But the idea seemed so involved and wearisome that I didn't say anything. I only burrowed down further in the bed. Then, through the sheet, I felt a slight, annoying pressure on my leg. I peeped out. The nurse had set her tray of thermometers on my bed while she turned her back and took the pulse of the person who lay next to me in Mrs. Tomalio's place. A heavy knottiness pricked through my veins, irritating and attractive as the hurt of a loose tooth. I yawned and stirred as if about to turn over and edged my foot under the box. Oh, the nurse's cry sounded like a cry for help, and another nurse came running. Look what you've done. I poked my head out of the covers and stared over the edge of the bed. Around the overturned enamel tray, a star of thermometer shards glittered and balls of mercury trembled like celestial dew. I'm sorry, I said. It was an accident. The second nurse fixed me with a baleful eye. You did it on purpose. I saw you. Then she hurried off, and almost immediately two attendants came and wheeled me, bed and all, down to Mrs. Mole's old room, but not before I had scooped up a ball of mercury. Soon after they had locked the door, I could see the Negro's face, a molasses-colored moon, risen at the window grating, but I pretended not to notice. I opened my fingers a crack, like a child with a secret, and smiled at the silver globe cupped in my palm. If I dropped it, it would break into a million little replicas of itself, and if I pushed them near each other, they would fuse without a crack into one whole again. I smiled and smiled at the small silver ball. I couldn't imagine what they had done with Mrs. Mole.